feel for the breadth of what physicists sometimes end up doing after they get their degrees, because there are a lot of different ways that physics can be applied in the world, and biophysics or biological physics is just one of those ways. The work I'm going to talk about isn't just mine, and it's always important to say that. It's work done by the whole of my lab group at Waterloo, former members of that group who are now at various places around the world, some of whom are shown here, and also collaborators. So I'm just trying to figure out which is the laser. Oh, no. Oh, dear. Let's see if we can get the laser. Oh, there it is. Some collaborators, SickKids Hospital currently. These are some former students who have various positions in industry and at universities. And I'll try to highlight as I go along the people who are responsible for some of the work that I will show. So what I want to do is give you an introduction to biophysics and biophotonics, and then tell you some of the goals of my research and give you some sample applications of physics to research on the eye. So I'm not going to cover even all of what I put into the abstract because it would just be too much, but I do want to emphasize that this is just a particular example of physical principles applied to biological problems. And in my case, it's a subset of biology that I look at, understanding the eye and understanding vision. Those are two things that I'm very interested in. And these studies can be theoretical or experimental, and in fact, I do both, and we'll try to show you an example of both. Physics can be applied to biology at the atomic or molecular level, at the cellular level, or at the organ level. So applying physics to the eye and vision is both at the level of the eye itself, which is considered the organ level, and also at the cellular level because we look at the processing of signals by the neural cells at the back of the eye. So what am I going to talk about today? Well, I'm going to talk about gradient refractive index optics of the crystalline lens inside the eye. It's a very interesting optical element, at least I think so. And the arrow is there to tell you that a lot of work that went on in optical fibers, gradient refractive index optical fibers, actually took advantage of some of the analysis that had been done in the lens, in the eye. It's been a very popular area, the optics of the eye, with physicists for a very long time. And I, in turn, drew some additional methods from optical fibers and optical fiber communications work in order to do my work on the eye. And so when I say it's a long-standing field of interest, one of my favorite stories is that Maxwell, of Maxwell's Equations, actually wrote a paper about his breakfast herring. His breakfast fish. So you guys, I think, had herring this morning. I could smell it. And so he sat down at breakfast, and he looked down at the eye of the fish that was in front of him, and he thought, now, how could that fish have perfect optics? How could the image be formed perfectly at the back of the eye? And so he actually postulated the form of the gradient in the crystalline lens, and it turned out he wasn't far wrong. So that's one of my favorite stories, and it's an interesting paper to read because it shows you how much the flavor of scientific writing has changed over the years. We're no longer able to tell stories about our breakfast when we write scientific papers. So that's a shame. It's much more interesting in some ways. So I'm going to also talk about optical signals guide eye growth and models of eye growth. And here I'm going to pull in some optical principles from Fourier optics and optical image quality metrics, which are well known in other areas of physics. And then I'm going to talk about adaptive optics and using adaptive optics to correct the eye to give high-resolution imaging. And here I'm going to use the same methods that the astronomers use, and I am, in fact, a member of the Center for Adaptive Optics. It's a National Science Foundation center in the U.S., and the people who belong to that center are both astronomers and vision scientists, so that the astronomers can teach us to do our adaptive optics on the eye better by showing us what they've done with their corrections at the observatories. So I have to put this in context to tell you what the structures of the eye are that are important to my discussion. So the light comes in this case, from a distant object, and the two optical elements are the cornea, which acts as a lens, which is on the front of the eye, separating air, a lower refractive index, from the cornea itself, which is a higher index. Then the light enters almost a water-like medium behind, and then the next optical element, which is the crystalline lens. And so this is the gradient refractive index optical structure. Its index is not homogeneous. It has a higher value at the center and lower values at the edges. So the light is focused through the lens and is ultimately brought to a focus on the back of the eye. And it's the back of your eye that starts to process those optical signals, receives the light, turns it into electrical signals, starts to process those signals, and ultimately sends those signals along nerve fibers that travel out along the optic nerve to your brain. So you communicate with your brain what you're actually seeing. But a lot of processing goes on in the back of the eye before the signals go to the brain. And here we have also blood vessels, which are important in various diseases as well. So I'm going to talk about the gradient of refractive index in the lens and how it helps to give us better vision. So first of all, if we have just a single surface refracting or a simple homogeneous positive lens, then the light from infinity does not all focus at one point as we go out to larger distances from the optical axis. And this is a rotational symmetry around the optical axis. This is just a cross section through that surface. Then this ray here at the edge focuses closer to the optical element than a ray at the center, which is focusing out here. And so that introduces blur, and that blur is known as spherical aberration. But then when we take a lens from a fish out of the eye, it's nice and spherical, and as I say, it has this gradient that there's a high value at the center of the refractive index going to lower values at the edge. And what you can see if you look carefully is that instead of just changing direction here at the surface and again here at this surface, the ray actually bends continuously. It is actually focused continuously, and there's a second-order differential equation that you can use to describe the path of that ray and how the refractive index actually influences the ray path. But most importantly, when we get to the focus, we don't have that spherical aberration that we have with a homogeneous lens. So the optics of the eye, of this particular fish, and the cornea doesn't have much power, so the fish relies on its lens, the optics is very sharp and very precise because of the gradient. So that's why it's been of some interest for some time. And we wanted to look at that refractive index distribution in the fish and figure out if it was tuned to their environment. In other words, did the lens grow? It grows throughout life. Does it grow? Does it create a gradient? And then that gradient is fixed? Or is there some feedback loop that might be related to what the fish is actually seeing? And so that's what we went to look at. And this work was done by Ron Kruger in my lab and myself when he was a postdoc. And he's now at Lund. And he is very much a comparative biologist. He loves fish and all creatures of the sea, actually. He did a master's porpoises, I think. So that's where he came to this from, and I came to it from a much more physics-based approach. So what we do is we shine the laser beams that you saw into the lens, and we look at their paths as they come out of the lens. And in this case, we have the lens now in a medium that takes away the surface refraction. So we've put the index of the medium up so that there's no refraction at the surface. All the refraction is from the gradient. And we measure the angles of these beams as a function of the incident position of the ray. And I was going to throw in the equation, the Abel integral transform that we use, and realized that I already had too much in the talk. So I'll just tell you that we then do an Abel integral transform that in the case of a lens with spherical symmetry, it immediately gives us the refractive index profile. So this is the refractive index as a function of position from the center of the lens, and you can see it's an almost parabolic shape. And that Abel integral transform only works exactly if we have something with spherical symmetry, and physicists, this is an example of physicists always choosing biological problems that are much simpler. We love the one-dimensional problems, we love the things that we can reduce much more to something we can get a handle on. And so the fish lens is the first lens that the refractive index gradient was solved for. So then after we know the profile, what we do is we put the, well, we think we know the profile depending on our accuracy of measurement. We put that profile into an optical ray tracing program like ZMAX or Code 5. Any of you in optics, any of you used any optical design programs? So this is just your standard optical design program. And we do the calculation of the ray paths and when we plot out where the rays are going. So this is the position of the focus of that ray, the crossing of the optical axis, as a function of distance from the center of the lens. If the lens were perfect, this would be a flat line. And you can see the lens is almost perfect, but there is still some blur. Some of the rays don't focus at the same place as all the other rays. And then we also go back and we remeasure that spherical aberration by putting the lens back into the same media or similar media as to what it would have in the eye, and we compare the measurement with the model. So we're comparing measurement and prediction. So we did all of that, and we did it for different rearing conditions. We were interested, does the actual exposure of the fish affect this gradient? And the answer is yes. So you can see here is the beam position. This is the entrance position of the beam, and this is the distance that it focuses from the back of the lens. And as I said, if it were perfect, it would be a flat line. This is only 0.2 millimeters, so there's very little deviation from the flat line. But you can see the fine structure here of the deviation is different for dark animals raised in the dark, animals raised in dim light, which is the thinnest line, and animals raised in white light. Those three curves are different. They're different in the measurement, and they're different in the predictions. The differences are tiny. And I will give Ron credit for racking his brain as to what these tiny differences would mean. And he is then, that brain racking he went through is the reason that we won a big award, because he actually came up with a very elegant reasoning as to why that existed. And what happens is in white light, so in normal conditions, normal bright white light, it turns out that if you shine that white light in the lens, you get this is the distance from the lens center, and this is the intensity of light that's focused. You get three peaks in the focus as a function of distance. So it's what we call a trifocal lens. So it turns out what's happening here is this middle peak corresponds to where green light would focus on the retina, and this peak back here, if you actually had white light going through, this peak would be moved back onto here because the lens would have higher power for blue light, and so this would then be coincident here, and this peak here in red light would also be moved onto the retina. So normally, if we look at a lens and we shine a white light into it, we get a different focus for each color, and we get what we call chromatic aberration and chromatic blur. And so this structure of the peaks indicates that this is the way the fish gets rid of chromatic blur, so that all three colors are in sharp focus at one position. So then when we raised the animals in dim light, all of a sudden we only get two peaks instead of the three peaks. And when we raise them in the dark, we only have a single peak. And so the answer is yes, the visual conditions are actually affecting the structure of, the fine structure of that gradient of refractive index in the lens. We still don't know what the feedback loop is, how the signals come from the retina or the brain back to the growth of the lens to actually modulate that growth. But this effect has been found by Ron in a number of species now besides the original fish that we worked on. So our conclusions were that both the gradient refractive index distribution and the measure of spherical aberration did differ as a function of the rearing conditions of the fish. And the lenses of the fish raised in dim light or darkness differed in their fine structure and in their image quality. And the lens is multifocal in white light, compensating for the fact that normally different colors would be focused at different points. And in other lighting conditions, this compensation disappears. So it means that visual feedback is necessary to maintain the fine structure of the gradient refractive index distribution. It's also the first indication that feedback loops in the eye actually operate on the optical structures. We've known for a while that there were feedback loops to growth, which I'll talk about a little bit later, but we didn't know that the optics could actually be influenced by visual conditions. And so this was considered a really important result. It was the very first result to show that. We went on then, I'm a physicist, so after I'm doing the spherical symmetry, you choose the symmetry that's the next easiest to do, and so you deform a sphere into an ellipsoid and look at an ellipsoidal distribution of refractive index, and it turns out a rat has an ellipsoidal crystalline lens. So this is just a ray trace through in ZMAX through the rat optics, but you can see that the elliptical model is the black, and if we considered the lens as spherical, we get the red curves. So it's only very slightly distorted from a spherical model, and it turns out that you can then do some clever things to use the same Averill integral transform and get the answer as to what the refractive index distribution is. Well, we're humans, and so we're interested in human lenses. They turn out not to have ellipsoidal symmetry or any simple symmetry, and these are the plots of the angle of exit, the plot that I said that we were interested in to get the refractive index distribution, angle of exit of the beam as a function of beam position, and this is going through the lens, which is a three-dimensional structure, in all of the three different directions. So you can send rays in parallel to the optical axis. You can send in rays perpendicular to those rays, but still in the same plane that you were originally in. Or you can send in rays just in the equatorial section. So there's three, if you've got a three-dimensional structure, there's three different orthogonal axes. So we send in rays parallel to each of those axes in turn. And you can see that the structure of these resulting curves is different. And that tells us that the lens does not have simple ellipsoidal symmetry, and its exact symmetry is an unsolved problem. Trish Pierce, who's now at AMO in the Netherlands, I talked a little bit about her last night, did come up with a model that is consistent with our measurements, and that has a refractive index that goes from the edge of the lens from 1.37 up to a center value of about 1.40, and is very flat in the center of the lens and then drops off. So quite different from what you saw in the fish. And instead of having spherical symmetry, her model suggests that the lines of surfaces of constant refractive index would be almost spherical near the lens center, but would be highly elliptical at the edge of the lens, and that they actually change shape as you go out through the lens. And so that's our current model of the gradient distribution in the human lens. There are a number of other models, but we do need to actually extend the work beyond what we've done to date. So it's interesting that Trish then took the fact that the gradient of refractive index balances the spherical aberration in the eye, and she took that concept and the change of spherical aberration with age in the human, it turns out the amount of spherical aberration changes, to design an intraocular lens implant. So I don't know how many of you have had parents or grandparents with cataracts. You're probably too long to have had cataracts yourself, but anyone who's had a parent or a grandparent with cataract. So it's a very simple surgery. They take the lens, the crystalline lens that you saw in the first diagram, out of the eye, and they put in, through a small incision, a lens that then unfolds in the eye and replaces the lens they've taken out. And she developed a new design to mimic the kind of spherical aberration that would give better image quality in the eye of older people, and that has been very successful. And as I say, she's now head of research and development for her company. So one of the reasons that the gradient in the human lens may differ from the fish is that you need to do something besides just look at distant objects. You look out at distance, and then you decide you're going to read, and so you're changing the power of your lens. When you decide you're going to read something and you're looking at something closer, the lens becomes more curved, it becomes thicker, and it has higher power, and so can focus on something nearby. And so that's when you're looking at distance, and then when you're looking at near. Well, that's fine for all of you. You can do that. You can just look down, and you can look out a distance, and you're doing just fine. I can't do that anymore. It's a sad indication of my age that I'm actually wearing a lens in front of my eyes that corrects distance for the top part of the lens and lets me read through the bottom part of my lens. And without that lens, I couldn't do both because I can't change the shape of my crystalline lens anymore. So that's true of everybody as they get older. And I don't know if any of your parents or grandparents have developed long arms. That's because they can't read it near anymore, and they're just putting the reading material further and further away. And so this is an indication of what we call presbyopia, the inability to read. So then the question is it based in a loss of muscle tone up here and down here, or is it based in the lens itself? And since we were doing measurements of these lenses, we thought this was something that we could look at. And Adrian Glasser, who did a postdoc with me, was the prime mover in this. And we have a lens from a human eye, actually postmortem. And these are the zonules you saw in the previous picture that pull on the lens to change its shape. So we mounted it in a, what we call a stretching apparatus, so we could actually change the shape. And then we could put laser beams through the lens. And this is an example, and we could change its shape and then put the laser beams back through. So for a young lens, you would get a focus out here when you were stretching the lens, when you had it in its flattened shape, and then when you stopped stretching it, the focus would move in here, and that corresponds to looking at near objects. But what we discovered was that that for older lenses, we could not change the position of the focus. We could stretch those zonules, and the shape of the lens did not change. So the answer is it's not in your muscle. It's all in your lens. Your lens actually hardens as a function of age, and that's why I've lost the ability to read it near. And so that also was an important result for others, not people from my lab, but others to go on and try to design corrections or fixes, you know, to soften the lens or refill the lens after surgery. And one of those possible cures is to use ultrafast lasers to soften the lens up and see if you can't fix this problem when someone gets older, and then they could read it near again. So how many of you are at all involved with ultrafast lasers in your research? Anyone here? Yeah, a couple of people. Okay, so the idea is that you would put in these ultrafast laser pulses, you would break some of the tertiary bonds between the molecules, and it's thought to be those tertiary bonds, cross-links in the proteins, that are making the proteins more rigid, and then you would use the femtosecond laser pulses to soften the lens. And in fact, they're already used to micromachine corneas during surgery, so femtosecond lasers have a very real use in medicine, in fact. And there is some evidence that pulse photodisruption can increase the elasticity of the lenses. But we were concerned about cavitation bubbles formed in the lens, and so with my colleagues in the department who work in ultrafast lasers, Joe Sanderson and Donna Strickland, we have started a project to look at the interaction of the ultrafast laser pulses with the crystalline lens. And we have published with Sharma, an Indian professor, a theoretical paper as well about the focusing of ultrafast pulses in the lens and the nonlinear optics of that. But here we're just taking infrared light, and we're going to generate white light, which is a nonlinear optical phenomena, and this we were doing as a marker of what the nonlinear interaction was. So, I'll have to start it again because I missed showing you. There's a little white spot that comes up partway through. There it is. You can see the beam, and you can see the little white spot there. And that is a marker of a nonlinear optical interaction occurring within the lens. And again, it's one of those things I decided I didn't have time to cover in detail in the talk, but it's to do with what we call self-focusing of the beam, and that generates a higher intensity and a change in the wavefront, and it gives you the white light that you see there from an infrared incident beam. So this idea that the crystalline lens was changed by the rearing conditions is part of a bigger question of how does the eye grow and how much do optical signals guide that growth. And we know that, that is true, because if you look at the optical components of eyes across all people, and you look at the eye length across all people, and you look at the statistical fluctuations in those, and you build a model, you say, how many people, if these statistical fluctuations were all random, how many people would be short-sighted? How many people would need glasses? And the answer is a whole lot more people than actually do need glasses. So what we know is that the retina is sensitive to whether the light is in focus or not, and the eye grows faster or more slowly in most people who don't need glasses in order to bring the image back into focus. And so we know that there must be some optical signal at the retina guiding that growth. We also know from some of the animal studies that the reaction of the growth is very quick. If you put a lens in front of the eye of an animal, within minutes or hours, the eye knows whether to slow down or speed up its growth. So we do know that it's a very fast process. So we wanted to look at the fine structure of those signals. And so if you have perfect optics, you would have a sphere, and that sphere would focus light to a single point, and then you would only have diffraction giving you your optical quality. And but in fact, the optics isn't perfect, and so the sphere, the reference sphere, is deformed into the true wavefront, and some of the rays, instead of focusing here, focus out here, and you end up with this blur like spherical aberration that I talked about earlier. And so we wanted to measure the aberrations in various eyes and look at whether that provided some kind of signal to the direction of growth. And so the way we did this measurement of the aberrations of the eye is borrowed from astronomy. This is a technique that astronomers use. They use a guide star. So how many of you know about astronomical adaptive optics? Yeah, a few of you, good. You use a guide star. In our case, it's just a narrow laser beam comes in, forms a spot on the retina. Then we let the light fill the pupil on the way out, and we have a Hartmann-Shack array of tiny lenslets out here that's optically conjugate with the pupil, and it's going to measure the actual wavefront coming out of the eye. So if the eye's optics were perfect, we'd expect a planar wavefront, and they're not, so the wavefront is distorted. And we want to measure the amount of distortion. And so we put that lenslet array in front. So here's a cross-section of the tiny lenslets. It's called a Hartmann-Shack array or a Shack-Hartmann array. And those lenslets, if it is a planar wavefront coming out of the eye, would focus the light at individual points. And in two dimensions, you would see an array of perfectly spaced points. And in fact, what happens is that the wavefront is distorted, and the focus of each point is shifted proportional to the slope of the wavefront. So you can see that the spot shifts are proportional to the derivative of the wavefront in the x and y directions. And so you end up with spots that are shifted. And we measure these shifts with respect to the reference. And then we invert a matrix to get back to the actual wavefront from the slopes. And that was well known by the astronomers. And so we thank them for allowing us to do these measurements a whole lot faster than we used to be able to. So now we in our lab were interested, given a wavefront, then what does the image look like? What does the blur of a single point look like, starting in the simplest case? So this is a point at infinity, and initially you have parallel wavefronts incident on the optical system. And if the optics is perfect, you end up with this green spherical wavefront. That's the ideal wavefront. And the image would be an airy disk. So for those of you who remember your optics, that's the green is the airy disk. And the real image formed by the real red wavefront, that we now know what that wavefront is, so we can calculate the real image. The real image is the red blur. And so a infinitely small spot has been blurred to a bigger blur than the diffraction blur. And that's not a good thing for your vision. But we want to know the structure of this blur and whether it can signal the eye. So how do we get to that? Well, we've measured this wavefront here, W, and so it turns out that the pupil function is just one inside the pupil and zero outside, and so we end up redefining a new function here, psi, that you define as a function of the wavefront aberration. And once you have that defined, then the point spread function, the PSF, is this function in the image plane, and this is the form of that function using what we've defined up here. And if you look at this function, you can see that the point spread function is just the modulus of the Fourier transform of the pupil function. So this is now our new pupil function. So the Fourier transform of this function, it's modulus, and then square the modulus, and that gives us the form of the blur in the image plane. And that's a calculation that MATLAB can do quite rapidly, which is a good thing. So we measure a wavefront. This is a wavefront out of someone's eye, and this is microns of error, and this is just color-coded across their pupil, so across their circular pupil. And you can see the amount of aberration is highest at the edges of the pupil. And then this is the resulting point spread function. So this person images a point, a perfect point, to a somewhat elongated blur, and that's maximum intensity there, here in the red, and then there's a halo of very low intensity light around it. And everyone's aberrations, it turns out, are different. What happens then when you look out into the world is you have some point spread function. You're imaging every point. Your optics is a linear system, so you're imaging every point to your point spread function. In this particular example from Larry Tybus, then that point spread function gets convolved with everything that you look at. And so if you're looking at a chart, because you're in at your optometrist or ophthalmologist, then you can see what happens is you can't resolve one of these lines because this point spread function convolved with the original target, the original letters, has introduced enough blur that you no longer see their shapes. And so that, you know, that's why you can only get down to a 20/20 line or a 20/15 line when you're reading the chart. It's limited by your optics. It's also limited by the sampling in your retina, but those two are fairly well matched. But again, this is an issue for us of, well, what does the eye know which direction it's defocused? How does it know to slow down or speed up its growth? So this would be a point spread function from one of our human observers at the best focus. And then as we defocus a quarter diopter or a half diopter in one direction or a quarter diopter or a half diopter in the other direction, the shape of the point spread function is different. And Austin Rorda, who was a PhD student with me and is now a prof at Berkeley, has gone on to show that individuals can actually recognize the direction of defocus from the shape of their individual point spread function. So that may be one mechanism your eye is using to know when you were younger whether to slow down or speed up its growth to bring images back into focus. We can't wait long enough for children to grow up, so we use chicks, and we put defocusing lenses on them, and they grow fairly rapidly, and they're not at all concerned about this lens, and their eyes change length in response to these lenses. So here we have a nicely focused eye with a distant object. And then we put a negative lens in front of that eye, and so you can see that puts the focus behind the eye. And so the chick goes, aha, I know I'm no longer in focus. I know that I must grow longer. The eye must grow longer. So the eye grows longer, and over a period of a few days, the eye speeds up its growth until the image comes back into focus. And then we remove the lenses, and we measure how much light is out of focus with respect to the retina, and we can figure out what's happened to the optics during this process and what's happened to the eye length. So we want to know what aspect of that point spread function is actually driving this process of coming back into focus, known as ametropization. So we have the amount of refractive error. We put a 20 diopter lens onto the eye initially, and the amount of difference between the amount the eye is out of focus is going to drop over a period of 14 days. And if we look at the area at half height of our PSF for that chicken, and as that changes as they as the eye comes into focus, we think that that's one of the things. It has a similar shape to the actual eye growth. We think that's one of the things that is actually driving the growth of the eye. It's trying to get a minimum area at half height in its PSF. What signal would it have in the short term in terms of direction? It would have that signal of the aberrations being asymmetric. But we've also measured the fact that the refractive error changes over a period of 24 hours. So you can see here a sinusoidal change over a period of 24 hours. And in the normal eye, that change is smaller. And as soon as we put the goggle on, that change increases dramatically. And so, you know, the over the period of a day, during daylight hours, the bird has the opportunity to see a number of states of defocus because the refractive error is fluctuating. And so we're postulating that that's another signal to growth in the eye. So what would we expect to happen to the optics of an eye just if it wasn't actively under control? So we have this idea from our early work that the optics is actively controlled. And so what would we expect to happen? We would expect just the whole eye to blow up in a passive enlargement. And you can figure out the magnification of that enlargement. And that model would predict that this particular measure of blur in the eye would stay constant over time because it's a blur that is divided by the radius of the pupil, which is also enlarging, and so it stays constant. We have a second model that we developed that suggests that the eye knows what the wavefront error is and keeps the wavefront error fairly constant, and that's our model here with some error bars on it, so an envelope of keeping the wavefront error constant over time, and then you would expect that the amount of blur in the eye would actually drop as it grows. And this is for a normal eye growing. This is not for a goggled eye. And then the experimental points show that, in fact, the wavefront error is dropping slightly, and the image is actually getting sharper over time, certainly much better than a simple model of growth and slightly better than our new model of eye growth. And we're interested in actually measuring whether there's just an inflation of the globe that is the eye growth. And one of the ways we can measure it is by imaging the back of the chick eye. So each of these points, and I meant to pick up my optical fiber bundle before I came, each of these points is a cone photoreceptor at the back of the eye. And cone photoreceptors are the things that absorb the light and give off the first electrical signals. But they're also waveguides. So how many of you have had a bundle of waveguides at Christmas time? You put a light in the bottom and all the tips light up. So I meant to bring mine in, but I didn't. And that's exactly what's happening here. We're putting light into the eye. It's traveling down the cone photoreceptor, and then it's being reflected back up, and then the tip is lighting up. So all of those bright spots are individual cones, and we can take a little movie of those cones, which is not working quite as well as I'd like it to, but maybe I can't even restart it. There we go. Yeah, so you can see just a little movie of the cones at the back of the eye. And then we can measure their spacing and what happens to their spacing as the eye grows to get a better model of eye growth. So imaging is part of what we want to do and for many reasons. One is modeling eye growth. There's lots of other reasons to want to do high-resolution imaging. And one of those other reasons is to look at the blood vessel structures, the cone photoreceptors, and the neurons at the back of the eye that are processing signals. So from our earlier work, we know how poor the optics is, and as well as teaching us to measure that, the astronomers have taught us how to fix that through adaptive optics. So this is a normal fundus photo of the back of your eye. There's your optic nerve going to your brain, the blood vessels you can see, and apart from that, you don't see a whole lot of detail back there on a regular fundus photo, and probably even less on this projector. And this, if you can see it, is just something that's been put there for the person to look at. It's not real. But we know that point spread function, if we look into the eye, is going to convolve with the structures at the back of the eye. So this is my example of a scene, and I then convolve a point spread function with that scene. And so one thing that happens is you no longer see the fine structures. These fine structures here have blurred here, so you can't make them out. But also you'll see that the image in general is low contrast, lower contrast. Blacks look gray and whites look gray, so that even these big structures here have a lower contrast than they did in the original object. And that happens when we look into the eye and photograph the back of the eye as well because of the poor optics. So it is definitely analogous to what the astronomers do without adaptive optics. This is the image that they acquired of this galaxy, and with an adaptive optics correction of the aberrations introduced by the atmosphere, that's the new image. And so that's what we set out to do, and others, but we did it in a scanning laser instrument for the first time with actually Austin Rorda and his group and myself. And so I want to tell you a little bit about this instrument. How many of you have heard about a confocal scanning laser microscope? No? So biologists would know about it. You take a light source and you focus it onto your sample, and then you reflect the light off and you put the light through a confocal pinhole. And the confocal pinhole means that if the light is focused deeper in the object, it will be focusing back here and be mostly blocked by the aperture. If the light is focused at a different plane up here in the object, then the light will be focused up here and again mostly blocked by the detector. So a confocal pinhole allows you to do what we call optical slicing, only keep this this particular part of particular plane of the object in focus. So we're doing something similar when we image the eye in our confocal scanning laser ophthalmoscope. Ophthalmoscope just means anything that that images the eye. And so we have a confocal pinhole in the same way. We don't have a lovely high-quality objective. We have the optics of the eye, which we know aren't the best that they could be, so that's the reason for the adaptive optics. Then, because we're putting it back through this pinhole, we have to do something else fancy. We have to scan the beam coming in. So coming in from the laser, this beam is scanning across the retina. And then it goes back through the same scanners, so it's stationary by the time it hits the pinhole. And then through timing signals, we send the intensity from the PMT to the computer, and the computer knows that, well, I'm in this line of the image and across the line, and then I got to the end of the line, I'm in the next line of the image. So we're doing what we call a raster scan, like a television does, from the top left down to the bottom right. And we're doing that at 30 frames a second. And at the same time, we are measuring the optics of the eye, because they do vary with your tear film thickness, so they're not fixed. And we measure them with the Hartmann-Shack device I've already shown you. And then we do this wavefront correction. And we do it in a feedback loop while we're doing the imaging. Not as fast as the astronomers do. We're not quite as good as the astronomers at all of this yet, but fast enough. So we do that correction both on the ingoing path of the light. So this is a deformable mirror. This is our wavefront correction. We measure that the person's optics is going to deform the wavefront into this shape. And so we pre-put that shape on the mirror. And then after this wavefront then goes through their optics, it will be perfect when it hits the retina. That's the theory. And then we also correct with the same shape on the way back out, because aberrations are reversible. So the light comes off the retina, it is distorted by the optics of the eye, it is fixed by the shape of the mirror, and the image that we form of the eye is perfect. And in a confocal instrument, you need to do this correction in both directions. And also, if we want to put light into the eye to activate drugs or do localized therapy, then the ingoing path is very important. So this is the improvement that we get. This is an image of, in fact, Austin Rorda's eye before wavefront correction and then after wavefront correction. So you go from seeing an occasional photoreceptor cone to seeing lots of his cones in the corrected image. And so for the first time, we can see individual cells at the back of a living eye. And you'll see this shadow is a shadow because the blood vessel's out of focus, but you'll actually see some blood flow in those blood vessels later on. Well, right now, actually. So these are images so we can look at blood flow in the eyes, and at the moment we're looking at early changes in the eyes of teenage diabetics, because eye disease and blindness is one of the complications of diabetes. So we have a project at Sick Kids Hospital, and here you can see the blood flow in this particular layer. You can see some flow in the big artery. I'm not sure how good this image is for you guys. You should also be able to see the flow in the smaller vessels as well. And in case you had trouble actually seeing that particular image, here's an image of a larger vessel where I think the flow will be much clearer. So you can see the two, the artery and vein, and you can see the blood flow in that particular vessel. And then you can also see a small vessel here that has some flow in it as well. So we can monitor blood flow with this methodology. And we are doing so, as I said, for normals and people with type 1 diabetes. And we're interested in looking at their cones in this layer and also the fine blood vessel structure, because many small bleeds are one of the first symptoms of diabetic problems in the retina. And we also have another AO-corrected instrument that I can't really talk about in detail. It's based on a Michelson interferometer. If you thought Michelson interferometry was boring, this is an optical coherence tomographer, and here we're seeing each of the cell layers of the retina, from the nerve fibers going to the brain, down through various different layers of cells, down to the pigment at the base of the retina, and the blood supply from the choroid beneath the retina. So we can actually measure the thickness of each of these individual layers. And this is a blood vessel here just going through the section. Okay. So in disease, we can also look at what the damage is. So these are normal cones. This is an image from someone with a disease, and you can see there's a patch of abnormality. And then what we can do is we can actually blow up the image and go to 1 degree of field. I'm not sure why this one isn't playing, but you can see that there are some intact photoreceptors, even though there's widespread damage, and there are other places where the photoreceptors are no longer there. So because of the need to correct the aberrations of the eye, and they're fairly large, we're also developing with Laval University a new mirror, which is a ferrofluid mirror, has actuators underneath it. Here we've just deformed the mirror with a very large magnet, and we float silver on top to make it more reflective. And the eye can also be a window on diseases of the brain. So here, I think you may have trouble seeing this. Can you see the vessels there and the tiny spots in them? Not really. I'm sorry about the projector quality isn't better. But yes, so I can see on my screen there are small malaria spots in there that have been brought into focus by polarization imaging. And here we have postmortem retina where we're staining for amyloid beta that's associated with Alzheimer's disease. And this is work with Zoya Leonenko in my department, who does atomic force microscopy. And so we have characterized these fluorescent deposits down to a scale of fractions of a micron. So this deposit is about 10 to 15 microns across and elevated. And you can see here that there is a change in the character of the material as well with respect to its surrounding material. So we're developing an in vivo method. We're hoping will be a diagnostic method of Alzheimer's disease by imaging the eye rather than having to image the brain with specialized PET imaging. So we do some polarization imaging, which I'll skip. We can look at individual photoreceptor structures, and we can look at how come fish are sensitive to polarization. And we can also localize the delivery of light, we hope. This is a project we're working on with the University of Toronto and the University of Calgary to try to close blood vessels by two-photon excitation of a photosensitive drug. So a drug that's sensitive to light, an ultra-short laser pulse that's been AO-corrected that we can just image onto a vessel and then attempt to shut down that vessel. This vessel shouldn't be there, and we want to shut it down before it damages the retina. And so for doing that, we're going to have to shine light on the eye for a while, so we also have to do some tracking of eye movements. And you can see that this image is somewhat more stable than the previous images you saw, except when there's a large saccade, so a large eye movement, which we can't track. So in conclusion, work can be done in applying physics to biology. There are huge numbers of applications, and fundamental research in understanding, say, the optical quality of the eye in turn led to important applied outcomes for diagnostic imaging and therapies. And careers in biophysics can be in academic departments, so I haven't talked too much about some of the other people in my lab, but for the signals to the direction of defocus, Jennifer Hunter was primarily involved, and she's now at a research hospital in Rochester. They can go to national labs, or they can end up in industry. So do have still openings for students and postdocs, and I'd like to acknowledge my funding. And sorry for running a little bit over.
Thank you very much. If we can get the next speaker to come and set up. And we'll be taking questions.
Just close that down so it doesn't get in your road.
Okay. Am I going first? Do you think it's possible to slowly step down a person's prescription on glasses and let the eye adapt, or is the adaptation of the eye kind of weakened by the point you get glasses?
Mm-hmm. And that is one of the big motivations of this work on signals, is the thought of, you know, should you be correcting kids when they first develop a problem, should you be correcting them with their full correction or partially, because they might, their eye might grow to be in better focus if you give them a partial correction. The work to date actually seems to indicate that it's important to give as sharp an image as possible to the eye, and so it is important to have the full correction. What's very interesting is that the latest work, our circadian rhythm work, ties into some other work that's being done that says that the biggest thing is to get exposure to bright light. So that it might not be that you're reading a lot and you become short-sighted. It might be that you're reading a lot indoors, and so your circadian rhythm gets out of sync. And there's a new theory that says you just have to be outdoors and you just have to be in bright light so that that rhythm of your refraction gets back into sync. Still a theory. We don't know the answers yet. But right now, the common thought is as sharp an image as possible. There are some new contact lens designs that are playing with the amount of defocus in the periphery of your retina versus the center, and they do seem to be being successful. So there may be a new design for people who are becoming myopic within a few years, which will try to drive the eye back into focus by driving the peripheral blur.
So my mom always told me that reading in the dark is bad for my eyes, and I always kind of thought that was a wives' tale, but it sounds like there might be some truth to that.
There may be some truth, but I don't think it's actually the reading in the dark. It's if you're always in dim light or you're not out in bright light. That's the latest theory, is that you need some bright light exposure, that kids who are out in bright light actually are less likely to become myopic. We still don't know if that's a depth of field thing, that their pupils close down, and so the image is sharper because of the small pupil. So we're looking into it at the moment with some experiments in my lab as well.